Please help me welcome our speakers, Heather W. from the Perry Hall Speakers Group in Baltimore, Maryland.
I'm Heather and I'm an alcoholic. I have to admit, I'm quite nervous. I've never spoken at a meeting this big before, so bear with me. Hopefully God will kick in quick. My sobriety date is January 30th, 2009. My home group, as you guys heard, is the Perry Hall Speakers Group, Tuesday nights in Baltimore, Maryland. It's at 8:30. If you're in the area, we'd love to have you. We love visitors. I have a sponsor. She sponsors me. I talk to her often. She is a sponsor who's active in the program as well. So I'll just start at the beginning, like any story. I was born to a man and woman, like most of us, I hope. And they found out they were pregnant with me. They got married. 20 months later, my younger brother was born. And we moved down to North Carolina. My father was in the Marines. And he was stationed over in Okinawa. He was sent away overseas. And that left my mom to meet somebody else who she brought into the house. And this was a man who... This was the first time I saw any drugs or alcohol in my life. And he liked to use substances. He liked to, for my birth mother to use substances. And they gave him the opportunity to do whatever he wanted to me and my brother. And I have to stress that does not in any way, shape, or form make me an alcoholic. I believe I was an alcoholic from the time I was born. But I can say that it started a pattern of thinking. A pattern of living for me. For the next 5 years, we moved around a lot. It was pretty chaotic. Two of them ended up getting divorced. We were back and forth between North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Maryland, New Jersey, whatever. And eventually they decided that it was better if they didn't keep me and my brother. And we were adopted to a wonderful woman and man, and I now consider them my mother and father. And that was probably the first time that God was working in my life, even though I didn't want to see it and I didn't want to believe it. I believe that God hated me for all the things that had happened to me. I blamed God for a very long time and wasn't willing to see the gift that I had there. A new life, a new way to start over for two people that loved me very, very much. I started thinking that I had to be perfect in every way possible in order for them to not, you know, give us up, not want us anymore either. And so that's what I strive for. I'm extremely excessive, so I had to get A's in everything, whether it was a homework assignment, a test, whatever, a pop quiz, didn't matter. I did that all through elementary and middle school. And I got into sports early on. I liked it. They started us in counseling when I was six because they realized there was something going on with me even that early on. And I went to therapists and counselors for a long time after that. And I just felt like there was something wrong with me. And I didn't know what it was. There was something in here that was missing. There's this gaping hole. And I could be around, you know, I have a friend who says this, I could be in a room with 100 clones of myself and I would feel alone. And when the first time I heard him say that, I could totally relate. You know, I felt the same exact way. I just didn't feel okay anywhere I was, no matter what I did. Just not okay. And my mind would race. You know, I'd have these scenarios in my head, and I'd play them out. I'd think about what you were going to say and how I'd respond to that and all the ways you could respond to that and all the ways I could respond to all those ways. I mean, just on and on and on and on. You know, and just that constant noise in my head that wouldn't shut up, and the constant committees going, as the big book says. And I lived like that for a very long time. Around middle school, it just, I guess, was taking a toll on me. I was feeling horrible about the person I was. I didn't like who I was at all. And I thought the best solution was to just end everything. That I'd be doing you guys a favor if I just wasn't here anymore. Because I was just so miserable. And so around age 13 or 14, I decided that my best option on this earth was to take my own life. And I had a couple attempts. I ended up in a couple institutions, a couple psych wards. And I remember my mom and my dad saying to me, like, what is wrong with you? Like, what is it? And it's like, I didn't know. I had no idea. I definitely agree with you. There was something seriously wrong with me. I felt like there always had been, but I didn't know what it was. And so off to more therapists and counselors and medications because we're going to try and fix me. And, you know, all growing up, my parents would have parties. They'd have alcohol in the house. Everyone in my family is pretty heavy drinkers. And so, you know, I don't remember my first drink. Whether it was Christmas time and we had, like, brandy in the eggnog or New Year's Eve having champagne or wine at Thanksgiving, whatever it was. I was always exposed to that. My parents would let me have a little sip. My grandfather would let me have a sip of beer or whatever. And, you know, I guess it was around age 13 or 14, I've been seeing my parents have these parties. And the people look so happy at these parties, you know, and they're drinking. And the more they drink, the happier they seem. And they're telling these stories, and they're goofing around. They seem okay around each other. And I never felt okay around other people. And I saw that, and I kind of stored that in the back of my mind, like in that memory bank for later on when I knew I would need it. And my parents had a full bar, a full-stocked bar in their basement. And one day I went down there and I got a bottle of Jack Daniels and a shot glass, and I just started pouring it with the intention to get intoxicated, with the intention to feel like what it seemed like these people that I saw felt like. So that's what I did, and that was my first drunk, and I remember it pretty well. I felt okay. For the first time, that noise in my head was gone. And I hear people say that they got taller and they got stronger and they got prettier and they could dance and all that kind of stuff, and that didn't happen to me. I just didn't care that I couldn't. I didn't care what you thought of me. I didn't care what I looked like. I'm still this, you know, chubby little, like, awkward kid. You know, I just didn't care anymore. And that was okay. You know, I was about 14 or so, like I said, so alcohol wasn't readily accessible. I'd steal from my parents whenever I could. And I shortly found out that my brother was doing the same things that I was. So we started doing it together. And we're really close in age, so we had a lot of the same friends. So we both seemed to find friends that like to do what we do. And we started hanging out with them. And my best friend at the time had an older brother. And we would hang out with them, and they would get us into places we definitely should not have been in at our age, and in situations we shouldn't have been in, and, you know, doing things we shouldn't have been doing. And, but that was okay. And my brother, I kind of flew under the radar. My brother was not so good at that. He was always getting into trouble and getting caught and getting, you know, in trouble at school. So the focus was always on him. The spotlight was on him. I could kind of just slide by. You know, I could still do the same things, but kind of just fly under the radar, and I was okay with that. And, you know, this time, we was in a really small Catholic school. My family raised us Catholic. My whole family is extremely Catholic. My mom's cousin was the principal of our Catholic school, and she was a nun. So it was like there was no escaping getting in trouble at school. Of course, Mom heard about it right away. But it was a small school, too, and it was a small community, a small church. So everybody knew what was going on with everybody, and word got around about the institutions I was in, the trouble that my brother was in. I was like that bad seed. You know, the parents didn't want their kids hanging around me. And my parents knew this, and they're just looking at these two kids, like, what do we do? And so they thought that they'd get us out of Baltimore City, and they'd take us up to the suburbs, to Harford County, about 40 minutes north, and we'd start over. Like, everything would be okay. I was on board with that idea. I was like, well, not exactly at first. I'm going to back up. There was a teacher at school that took this interest in me, and I didn't understand why. And she told me I had potential, and she said that I was smart. I just didn't apply myself, and she kept pushing me, and I manipulated that situation, I think like a lot of us tend to do. And, you know, I'd go to her so I could get out of class. I'd go to her so I'd get better grades, and she would kind of slide, you know, help me out with my grades, even though she probably shouldn't have. And she told me that I could get into a really good private school, like this really prestigious school. And I didn't believe her because I really didn't think much of myself or my abilities. But she kept pushing. And she convinced me to take this test and apply. And I'm like, okay. And the test came back, and I scored pretty high. Even the fact that I got a scholarship to this school. And I told my mom and my dad, I applied to this school, and I got, you know, I got in, I got a scholarship, and they're like, you're never be able to make it there. Like, you don't apply yourself. You don't do the work, you know? So, of course, I'm like, I have to go to this school. You know, like, this is what I've always wanted to do kind of thing, you know? And it turns out we didn't, because, like I said, they moved up to Hartford County, and that wasn't an option. And but I remember that teacher, you know, and that she had taken that interest in me. And nobody had really, you know, done that. And so we went to Hartford County, and I get to start over. I get to be whoever I want to be. I'm going to be a good kid now. You know, I'm going to do what I'm supposed to and stay out of trouble and get good grades and make my parents proud because they've been so disappointed up to this point. So I tried that for a while, and I was doing pretty good. And like I said, I'm excessive. I threw myself into sports. I was playing 3 sports a season. I fell in love with field hockey. I was a goalie. And senior year, I made for Seymour County. And I was like, this is great. This is where it's at. And, you know, by the end of high school, I kind of got into, you know, I seemed to find people that like to do what I do. And I got into a crowd. And, you know, I was a binge drinker through high school. So on the weekends, we'd go and binge. And I feel like, well, that was okay, because during the school week, you know, I'm doing what I'm supposed to. And, but I'm binging whenever I can, whenever I get my hands on what I want. Because, you know, I can stop for a period of time, but eventually, like, I have to have it again. And so that's what I started doing. And my grades are slipping, and my coaches are getting on me because, you know, if my grades fall, I can't play sports. And so I'm doing enough to get by. And my brother's alcoholism and addiction really kicked off during this time. You know, and I know I'm talking a lot about my brother, but he's a big part of my story, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But he was just getting into a lot more trouble than I was. So, again, the spotlight was off on him. It was off of me. I could kind of slide by and do what I needed to do. And senior year, I figured, you know, by this time my grades are slipping so much, I'm not looking at college as an option. I'm thinking the only way I can get into college is through sports. So, and things are getting really bad at my house with my brother's addiction, and I just want to get out of there. And I'm thinking the only way I can do that is to go away to college. And that was the goal. That was the big plan. And senior year of high school, I finished up hockey season, and I was playing basketball, and I broke my ankle. I tore the ligaments in it, and they told me I wouldn't play for the rest of the season. And now the coaches aren't looking at me for college, you know, and I'm thinking, what am I going to do? And so I kind of just say, okay, I don't care. And I just took off with the drinking. By senior week after graduation, my aunt, it was my birth father's sister. I'd always stay in contact with her all through childhood and growing up. We were really close. And she had this place down at the beach, and she told us we could stay down there for 8 days. So me and my 2 best friends from high school, we go down there, and, you know, it was 8 days, and I was drunk and blacked out for the first 5. Didn't remember any of it. Day 5, they sat me down and they said, you know what you've been doing the last 5 days? I'm like, not really. You know, maybe you can fill me in. And the things they told me were despicable. The things they told me just, you know, I couldn't believe I'd done or said or whatever. And they said, you know, we think you have a drinking problem. That was the first time somebody came to me and said, I think you have a drinking problem. I think you need to stop for the rest of the time we're down here. And I swore I would. So, oh, yeah, no problem. I don't have a problem. I can stop whenever I want to. I just don't want to, you know. So I promised them that I wouldn't drink those last 3 days, and I didn't hold up that end of the promise. You know, I would have to sneak a little bit here or there to kind of just take the edge off. I came back from that weekend, and I swore, you know, I wasn't going to do this anymore. I wasn't going to be that person. I was going to start over. I was going to try and go to community college, get a nursing degree. Everybody kept pushing me towards this nursing thing. They thought I'd be good at it. I'm like, okay, I don't really have any good ideas, but I'll try it. And I met this person, got in a relationship around that time, and I felt really good around this person. They saw something in me, just like that teacher had back in middle school. And I felt good around them, and they felt good about me. And that ended up being a 6-year relationship. And he didn't like me to drink very much, so, you know, I had to cut back, and I'm trying to stop. And basically, you know, I was a dry, untreated alcoholic, and I made his life miserable. It was absolutely miserable. We ended up moving in together. The plan was that we were going to get married because I thought that would fix me. I had to have a nice little house and a white picket fence and, you know, the pet cat and everything, and everybody would be happy and the family would be happy, and it's not how it happened. Somewhere in there, I ended up with a job. I dropped out of school because I wasn't really showing up for school. Kind of got to go to class in order to pass, and that wasn't something I was really fond of. So I decided I was going to get a job and I was going to work, and that way I could get out of my parents' house and move into my own place, because, again, that was the goal, to get out of there. And I ended up with this job I completely did not deserve. And I started out at a low position, and I worked my way up. And they promoted me into information technology, and they taught me the software and the systems and the procedures and the policies, and they said I learned it really quickly. So they wanted me to become the trainer for the company. And what that meant is we have like 25 offices in the company, and there's one in Maryland where I live, and that's the corporate office, and the rest are all in other states. So that meant traveling. So I would go to these other offices and I'd train people, and that was like a little vacation from home, and I could go to these cities and I could drink however I wanted to. I had nobody watching me or telling me, oh, you're having too much. Maybe you should slow down. Maybe you should cut back. And I could just go and do whatever I wanted to for however long I was there. And I would start when I got on the plane. I'd find a bar when I landed. I'd stay up all night. I'd go to the office, do what I need to do, leave the office, go to a bar, stay up all night, and just kept doing that until I had to get on the plane and come back home. And I started to see some consequences. I didn't look at them as consequences at the time. I looked at them as, you know, this is fun. This is just what happens when you drink. You know, this is just it's just the way it goes, you know. And coming out of a blackout in the Atlanta airport, not knowing where I am, having to look at my boarding passes to figure out where I'm going and where I've been. And that was scary at first. It was the first time I came out of a blackout, and I wasn't laying in bed. I wasn't, like, waking up. I was, like, talking and coherent, and just all of a sudden, boom, I'm in an airport with a ton of people around me. And other things like alcohol poisoning in Fort Myers, Florida, and not knowing where I was and not knowing how I got there, and it's just things like that kept happening, and it wasn't enough to make me look at what I was doing. I didn't think alcohol was the problem. That relationship, the six-year relationship, ended up kind of, well, I ended it. I figured that wasn't working anymore, that I was done, I was moving on. And so I moved out and with a friend. And now there was nobody to really watch me, nobody keeping tabs on me, nobody I had to answer to, and I could do whatever I wanted. But I was starting to feel pain inside that I had felt before, and I didn't know what to do about that. I had a therapist around that time, and she suggested some alternative medicine. She said, you know, why don't you try some yoga? It'll be relaxing for you, some acupuncture, you know. And so, like I said, I'm excessive, so I started, like, researching that and started looking into it. And I figured maybe this would fix me. It was something I hadn't tried yet. And so I was going to shamanic healings. I was going to chakra healers. I was getting massage. I was going to yoga class. I'm going to acupuncture, you know, and just trying anything. And I stumbled upon this yoga studio, and I walked in for the first time, and they were having an open house, and I just felt at home. I couldn't explain it to you. I to this day don't understand it, but I just walked in and I felt at home. There was this peace, this serenity there. And these people there were talking about spiritual principles. They weren't talking about the religion that I grew up with. They didn't have opinions. They were kind of just this open-minded group of people talking about spiritual principles. I'm like, okay. And I met a woman there. She became a mentor to me. She was an acupuncturist, and she studied Chinese medicine. She would just start teaching me everything she learned and everything she knew and sharing her experience with me. And I'd go there, and I just listened to her, and I didn't know why, but when I talked to her, I felt better. I felt okay. You know, that noise in the head was gone for a little bit of time. And, you know, the big book talks about that. The big book talks about Bill and Bob sitting down and just one alcoholic sharing with another alcoholic, talking about spiritual principles. of how the Washingtonians were founded in 1840 when, you know, a couple of guys sitting in a bar just not drinking, white knuckling it. And they go and they hear a spiritual talk and they come back to the bar and they're not even thinking about drinking anymore. And the lights come on and it's 2 a.m., it's last call. And they think, where's the night gone? We had a great time. You know, and, you know, that's one of our principles that are in this book. Just one person sitting down and sharing with another person. I didn't know that at the time. You know, looking back, I see a lot of things I didn't notice before. And this was the first time that something like that was introduced to me. And so I started working at this yoga studio in exchange for free yoga and acupuncture. And because I really wanted to be around this woman, I just wanted to learn everything I could. I picked up any books I could about Buddhism, Hinduism, Chinese medicine, anything. I just read anything I could because I thought the answer's got to be in here somewhere. You know, because I feel good when I was there, but when I left, it was a different story. And I know today is because there's something inside me that's still untreated. You know, I can sit down and talk about spiritual principles, but there's still some action I have to take. And I wasn't doing that. So I'm working at this studio and just trying to absorb all of this stuff. Sorry, I've got like really bad dry mouth tonight, so... you know, around that time, I'd sworn off God a long time ago, and I'm hearing all these people at this studio talking about these spiritual principles, and I kind of got this concept of, like, maybe there is something bigger than me out there, and, like, I like to think of it as the universe or the stars or nature or something like that, and there's something going on, I don't know what it is. The God word was not in my vocabulary in the least. That wasn't an option, but maybe something out there. And so I found myself one night in the summer just sitting outside looking at the sky, looking at the stars and saying, okay, I'm trying to live a good life. I'm trying to do what I'm supposed to. I'm learning from these people that are teaching me these things, but what gives? You know, like, I still don't feel okay inside. You know, I feel okay for the couple hours I'm there and I go home and I still don't feel okay. And I'm living this double life because when I leave there, I'm still going out and I'm drinking. You know, I'm still finding these people that like to drink like me. And it's just this total double life. So I'm kind of just looking at the stars and I say, you know what? Whatever you have me do, wherever you'll have me go. thank you. I'll do it. I'll do it to feel good. I don't care where it is. I don't care what you'll have me do. And, a couple weeks after that, I met somebody and my drinking took off. And I'm baffled. I'm like, look, I said I would do whatever you wanted. Just help me to feel okay. Just help me to feel good. And this is what happens. You know, like, I feel like I have to drink more than ever. I feel less okay than, you know, than I ever did before. And I'm like, okay, forget it. You know, like, nothing was answered. Forget it. And again, I just didn't care. And I got in with a group of people that started introducing me to other substances. And I'm drinking every day. I was a binge drinker up to that point, and now I'm drinking every single day. And there's these lines in the sand that I drew, things I said I would never do, and now I'm crossing that line. And I have to keep moving that line back further and further to justify what I'm doing. And I'm not liking the person I'm becoming. In fact, I can't even look in the mirror. And it got to a point, this was New Year's Eve, this past New Year's Eve, and I'm partying with this group of people and doing a bunch of different substances and drinking a lot, and something happened that had never happened before. It was like my body was drunk, but my mind wasn't. My mind was totally coherent, and I'm sitting there, and I'm so intoxicated, I can't even move. My legs won't work. I'm sitting there with this group of people, and I'm looking around, and I'm just kind of observing everything, and I'm totally coherent mentally, which is just baffling to me. And it was kind of like I didn't want to be in me anymore, so I kind of left. And I'm looking at myself, and I don't recognize the person that's sitting there. In fact, I'm appalled. Absolutely disgusted. You know, like, who is she? I don't even know her. And I got to another point where I felt like something needed to change. I couldn't keep living like this. And you know, when I first got to AA, I heard people talk about losing the car and losing the house and losing the family and the wife and getting the DUIs and the car crashes and the crimes and the charges. And I came into those rooms, I didn't have any of that. But what I did have was the feeling from that night, the absolute emptiness, the spiritual, just nothing there. And that was enough pain for me to try and do something different. But I didn't have any answers. I didn't have a solution. I didn't know what to do. Around that time, my brother was in rehab. My brother's an alcoholic, and I can tell you that because he's told me he's an alcoholic. He's been around these rooms for a long time. And he was in rehab, which was a common thing for him. And he just got out of rehab in January, and he asked me if I would take him to some meetings because he couldn't drive and he didn't have a car. And I said, sure. I thought, maybe this is my answer. Not because I wanted to be here. I thought I could come here and I could listen to all of you guys who are alcoholics. Because I wasn't. And I could figure out what not to do. Like, this is the genius plan I had. All right, I'm going to listen to their war stories. I'm going to figure out how they got in trouble. And this is how I'm going to avoid it. And that's not what happened. Surprise, you know. I came in here, and I was up in Hartford County, and I was sitting in the same meeting every day at this clubhouse. And there's these older guys, like these old-timers. They're all smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee, and I'm just not relating, you know. I'm like, I'm not like these people. It's not me. I'm not like them. But that's okay, because I don't need to be. I'm not one of them. I'm not an alcoholic. I'm just going to sit here and listen to them. A funny thing happened. I've been sitting there for a couple weeks, and I see them give out these chips. He said they were like a 24-hour chip. And I thought that meant you had to have 24 hours sober, and I hadn't sat in a meeting yet where I'd had 24 hours. And so I thought I couldn't go and get one. And it was okay because I didn't want one anyway, because I felt like if I got that, there was like a contract, like I was signing over my life to you guys. And I didn't want to do that. So I stayed away from those things. You know, I would sit there and I'd watch my brother. I'd be like, I hope he's getting it this time. I hope he's hearing something really good that he really relates to. And what happened is that I did. There was a gentleman, he's a home group member now. I know him now. And he gets up and he says he got sober when he was 16 years old. And he didn't have this big drunk log, and he just talked about this hole in the soul he had. You know, he said he was an alcoholic, and look at this guy. He's a fairly good-looking guy. He's got a suit on, nice shoes. He got it all put together, well-spoken, you know. I'm thinking, that's not what I think of as an alcoholic, you know. Like, I have these stereotypes in my mind, and I'm like, okay. I'm listening to him. He's talking about, this is the guy that said, you know, I could be in a room of 100 of my clones and not feel okay. And I feel completely alone. And I knew exactly what he was talking about. I knew exactly. He talked about this hole in his soul and the fact that he had this spiritual malady and that was part of his disease that he had. And I'm like, okay, I get that. And, you know, he said he felt uncomfortable and he would, look at you and he couldn't look you in the eyes. So he'd try to figure out if he'd look at the right eye or look at the left eye. Maybe he should look right in between the eyes. So maybe the eyebrow, so you didn't know I was looking right in your eyes, you know, like, and he's going through this whole thing. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I know what he's talking about. And then I'm like, oh my gosh, what does this mean? So, and he says he's an alcoholic. And I'm thinking for the first time, there's a possibility I might be an alcoholic, you know, but I'm not willing to accept that yet. And that was January 28th. It was a Wednesday night. Thursday night, I went down to that yoga studio and I worked. And some of the people afterwards were going downstairs. There's a bar and a restaurant underneath the studio. And they go down there and they're just going to have a bite to eat and a drink. I'm like, okay. And I'm telling myself, I'm not going to drink. You know, I'm not going to do it. I go down and they're all having a glass of wine. They're like, oh, you can have one. It's not a big deal. I go, yeah, I can have one. It's not a big deal. And one turned into two. And they're ready to go home. They have families to go home to. And I'm like, go home. You know, like, it's just starting. And I don't want to go home. And I'm looking for something to do. And I see it, this girl over at the bar that I knew. And she waves me over. I'm like, okay. And I go over and I sit with her and she buys me a drink. And she buys me another drink. I told her it's getting late and, you know, I have to drive. So I start to drive home and I'm going up the road. And there's a police officer that pulls me over. And I'm thinking, okay, I saw him back there. I wasn't speeding. I really don't know why I got pulled over. And he comes to the window and says, you know why I pulled you over? I'd been pulled over plenty of times, so I knew the drill. I had the license and registration out already, ready to go. So I don't really have to talk to him. I know how they put their head in the window just to try and smell my breath, to see if there's anything in the car. You know, I know the drill. And so I'm trying not to speak, kind of like leaning over. And hand him their license registration. She says, you know why I pulled you over? I said, honestly, sorry, I don't. He said, you don't have your headlights on. I'm like, oh, my gosh. I had the parking lights on, but I hadn't clicked it all the way. So it looked like, you know, the dash was lit up. And I'm in the city, so there's a lot of lights. And I didn't even realize. And he's just looking at me and looking at me. And he goes back and he runs my license. And I'm sitting there saying that Foxhole Prayer. And I'm sure there's at least a couple people in here know what I'm talking about. You know, God, please just help me. If there's a God up there, if there's something up there, please just help me. Get me out of this. I can't get arrested. I can't get a DUI. And the police officer is taking what seems like forever. And he comes back to the window and he's just looking at me confused, like just baffled. And I'm like, he's going to ask me to get out of the car. I know he is. I know he's going to ask me to get out of the car. I know he's going to ask me to get out of the car. And he just looks at me and he says, have a good night. And it's like when he says this, he looks confused, like he's not sure. And he's like, have a good night and be careful. I said, yeah. I drove home and I swore that would be the last night. And as of today, that was the last night that I drank. My sobriety date is January 30th, the next day. That was a Thursday. I ended up going back to those meetings I was telling you about up in Harford County. And on a Sunday night, it was Super Bowl last year. I remember sitting in that meeting thinking, I could be watching football right now, you know? And what had happened that weekend is that I called up my aunt, that aunt that I had stayed at her place at the beach, I was really close to. And I called her up and I said, I got a problem. I think I might be an alcoholic. And she said, okay. And she met me for coffee. And she said, that's okay because I'm an alcoholic. And I'm like, really? She's like, yeah, I've been going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a couple of years sober, and that place has changed my life. And she sat down and she shared her story with me, and she said, you know those 6 years that I was just kind of absent from your life? You know, you didn't know where I was. You'd call, I wouldn't return your calls. And I said, yeah. And she said, well, and she explained to me the kind of life that she was living. You know, she was getting arrested. She was living in the streets. She was living in crack houses down in Baltimore City. And I'm looking at her, and I know that that's not the person that's before me today. Something had to have changed. And she said, why don't we go to a meeting tonight? And we went up to that meeting on that Sunday night, Super Bowl. And I heard this woman speak. And this woman just had an amazing story. Just blew me away. And I think if I wasn't so like empty and dead inside, I probably would have cried. But I just couldn't even do it. And after that meeting, there's this girl that came with her. And she came up to me after the meeting. And I picked up a 24-hour chip that night. I didn't know why I did it. It was like one of those things, I'm sitting in the chair and they asked anybody, you know, once. It was the first time I'd heard somebody say, 24 hours or a desire for a new way of life. And I had that desire for a new way of life. And I felt my legs get up and walk up that aisle and I'm like mentally fighting, like, why are you walking up there? Like, do you know what you're doing? But they kept moving anyway. I'm like, oh my God. So I went up and I got that chip, and this girl came up to me after the meeting and she just talked to me, and she was really nicely dressed. She had makeup on and her hair's done and she's young and pretty, and I'm like, she can't be an alcoholic. She can't have done the things I've done. Like, there's no way. And she told me about this meeting on Tuesday nights in Perry Hall, and she said you should come, and I took her number with no intentions of ever calling her. And I went home the next day, and Tuesday came, and I got this problem where my curiosity gets the better of me. Yeah, exactly. And so I just had to know. You know, this girl had this light in her eyes, I mean, just happy. Happy to be at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was baffling to me. And and she just had this light and this glow about her, and I had to find out what it was. And so I found myself at that meeting that Tuesday night, and when I walked in again, I felt at home. I felt okay. I felt like there were people there like me, and I just didn't get it. But it was cool, you know. And I sat there and I listened to the speaker. I have no idea what that speaker said. The same girl that had told me about, she came up to me right when I got there and remembered my name and remembered some things I told her, and was just so welcoming and had a seat for me and introduced me to people. And there's all these young people there that look like me that I can relate to. And I thought, okay. And no idea what that speaker said that night, but that woman that I heard speak on Super Bowl came up to me after the meeting. She said, honey, and she's from Boston. She said, honey, you look miserable. I said, I am. So why should I be happy? I'm sitting here in Alcoholics Anonymous and I can't drink anymore. So I can't go out and have fun and party. And she said, okay. I said, besides, I'm not even really sure I'm an alcoholic. You know, I'm not even sure I belong here. And she said, well, tell me about your drinking. And the thing that came to mind was, I'd been at a company Christmas party recently. And I remembered that I watched how many drinks everybody else had, and I'd count them so that you wouldn't see me have more than that. And but I go to the bar and sneak them, so you didn't know that I had them. And I'm telling her this. She goes, whoa, 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 stop right there. She said, do you think people that aren't alcoholic think like that? Like, okay, you got me. Yeah, I don't have anything for that. And she said, what are you doing to stay sober? I said, I'm not drinking. She said, what else are you doing? I said, I'm coming to these meetings. She said, what else are you doing? I said, what else is there to do? And she kind of laughed, and she said, you can get a sponsor. You can get a home group. You can work these steps. She said, these steps are a guide to living, and they've changed my life. She said, and I guarantee you that if you work these steps, you will have results. And I said, okay. And the girl that approached me, she and her sponsor took me out to the diner that night, and they just sat there and they shared their experience with me. They didn't tell me what to do. They didn't make suggestions. They didn't try to fix me. And they just shared their experience, and I could relate to her sponsor, and I ended up asking her to sponsor me. I was told when I got here, find somebody that has what you want, that looks happy to be here, and ask them how they got that way, and then do what they did. I'm like, okay, that sounds pretty simple. And then about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I had a problem with that, because, see, I'd heard them being read at these meetings I was going to, and they had the G-O-D word in them. I wasn't really okay with that, and the girl that sponsored me, she said, just work the first step right now. It doesn't have the word God in it. She said, let's just start there. We'll get to the rest. If you don't want to get to the rest, we don't have to. And she was talking about unmanageability, and that woman from Boston talked to me about it too. And so my brother said, my life's fine. It's completely manageable. Like, I got it all under control. I got a car, I got a job, I just got promoted in that job, I got a raise and bonus, you know, the whole thing. So I got a place to live, you know, I'm doing all this stuff. I'm like, okay, and she had me write down ways that I had tried to stop drinking and whether or not I was successful at it. It ended up being a pretty big list, you know, like not taking money into the bar, asking somebody to take my keys, you know. Because that would keep me from drinking. I'm being sarcastic, of course. And, you know, and I went through this whole list with her. And when it was out on paper, I could kind of see where the unmanageability was. And, you know, we talked about powerlessness. You know, that I had no defense against that first drink. And I knew that. I tried to stop drinking. You know, I told myself my whole life that I didn't want to stop drinking. But if I wanted to, I could. And that month, I wanted to, and I couldn't. I just couldn't. I know today that when I try to run the show, when I try to force my will, when I live on my ideas, things don't go well. I eventually got to that third step, giving my will and my life over to God as I understood him. And my sponsor emphasized the "as you understood him" part. And she said, you know, do you believe in something bigger than you? And I said, yeah. And I thought back to that time that I was looking up at the stars and, you know, looking up at the sky and remembering that there's something bigger than me. And I'd grasped that at one point, although I'd thrown that away. I had grasped it at one time. And I thought back to that. And she said, that's enough for now. She said, you know, she also said, do you believe that I believe? And I said, yeah. And she said, okay, that's enough for now, you know. And I got into the fourth step. I hear a lot of people say they don't want to do that fourth step. I was ecstatic to do that fourth step. I was going to tell you everybody that ever hurt me, you know, everybody was angry at, and I was going to tell you exactly why. And I was going to tell you how they all wronged me. And that was the first step I had no problem with. That fifth step, you know, that was a little, I had a little fear about that. But I shared it with this woman, and, you know, I found myself telling her things that I never told another soul on this earth, things that I was ashamed of, and things that I regretted. And I felt a huge weight lifted from me. This huge weight. I'm going to get into a couple of stories, some things that have happened to me in sobriety. I told you I traveled for that job, and one of the places Facebook was going to send me was Tampa, Florida. And I called my aunt up, who I was pretty close with, and I told her, I'm like, hey, I'm going to Tampa, Florida. And she said, oh, funny thing. She said, your birth father just moved to Tampa, Florida. I said, oh, yeah. And I know that he liked to drink the way I liked to drink. And I asked her, I said, you know, how's that going? I'd always wanted to meet him, but I knew that the life he was living wasn't something that I wanted to go down and see. And she said, well, actually, your father's sober now. I was like, really? And he was staying down there with their other sister, my other aunt. I said, how's she doing? She said, well, she's sober too. This was the first time that all four of us had been sober in my entire life. And I felt like I was being called to go down there for a reason. When I talked about my resentments with my sponsor, I had a big resentment against him for giving us up as a kid. And, you know, we used that fifth step for our eighth and our ninth step to make amends, and I couldn't see where I owed him any amends. You know, I was this little kid. What did I do? And my sponsor was quick to point out to me that my part was that I carried that around for all those years. I let it affect me. I let it affect my thinking, and that was the part I played. So if even a little tiny incidency part was mine, I need to go clear up that side of the street. So I went down to there, and I met him, and I hadn't seen him in over 15 years. And I told him that I forgave him, and that I didn't blame him, and I knew that he had done the best he could, and in what he did, he gave me a life. A great life with two loving parents who could never have kids themselves. And I just started sharing some of my experience with him and some of the things. And he went into this other room, and he got something. He said, I've had this, and I want you to have it. I said, okay. And he brought out this blanket. Sorry. He brought this blanket. It was a white blanket. And I asked him what it was. He said, this is the blanket we wrapped you in when we brought you home from the hospital. And he said, I've carried it with me my entire life. And he told me the countries he'd been to, all over the world, in the Marines. And he would go on road trips around the United States. He told me all the states he'd been to. He just told me all these things he'd seen and all these experiences he had. And he said, this blanket was with me through it all. And in a way, I felt like you were there with me. And he said, I'd look up at the sky, at the stars. And I'd imagine that you were looking at the same ones, and somehow we were still connected. And someday I'd be with you again. Sorry. And he gave me that blanket, and I still have it. And that was just an amazing experience. And had I not been sober, and had he not been sober, and had I not found this program, I never would have been able to do that. I never would have had that gift in my life. I still talk to him every week. And he's going through a lot of hard stuff. I get to be there for him. I get to absolutely be there for him. And a couple months, and it was his birthday, by the way, that I met him on. And he said, you know, this is one of the best birthday gifts I could have ever had. And God works in a funny way. I ended up getting sent back down to Florida again, into Tampa. And this time, I have a sister. I've known about her for a long time, but I didn't know if she knew about me. When I met my dad, he told me that she knew about me. And although she wasn't there at the time, he wanted me to come back and meet her. And when I went down to Tampa again, that's what I did. I never had a sister before, and I went down there. It was her 15th birthday. I met her on her birthday. Yeah. And she got to have this party, and she and I went out to the store to get some supplies for the party and everything, and she looked over at me, and she said, you know, my dad talks about you all the time. He's so proud. And I'm like, of me? He's proud of me? And she says, yeah. He says that his dream would be for me to grow up and to be like you. And I just start talking to her, and she said, you know, sometimes Dad and I fight. I'm like, well, yeah, you're 15, that happens, you know. She calls him now for advice. You know, she's lived with that man for 15 years. I've just been reunited with him and known him for a few months now. And she calls me for advice on what to do with him. You know, when they get in an argument, when she disagrees with something, or he's struggling with something, or she's struggling with something. And she asked me what we were doing. And that day we sat in the car, I just shared some of my experience with her, and I talked about spiritual principles and things that you guys have taught me, you know, and things that you have shown me. And that, it was just an amazing experience. You know, I got to a point in sobriety. I ended up switching sponsors after I worked the 12 steps with that first sponsor. And God has a funny way of putting people in my life. And he put that woman from Boston that I'd heard that Super Bowl Sunday. She just kept showing up in my life. And I eventually asked her to sponsor me. And that's my sponsor today. And I worked the steps again with her. This time having a new understanding and was able to get a little deeper into them. But I stopped moving my feet. You know, I said before that I can sit down and talk one person with another about spiritual principles, but there's certain actions I have to take. For me, I know I have to pray every day. I know that I have to turn that will over every day. I know that I need to go out and carry this message to someone else. In order to keep this, I have to pass it along. And that's my responsibility. And so I'm thinking that's enough. And so I'm praying every morning, and I'm going and finding the newcomers. I'm driving people to meetings. But something's not right. I'm not feeling okay, and I don't know what it is. And I got to tell you, I got to a point of misery in sobriety. Absolute misery. The desire to drink had been removed a long time ago. I had no desire to drink. I had no desire to use anything else. But I just wasn't okay, like irritable, restless, and discontent, and I don't know why. And I don't get it, and I'm thinking, okay, I need to help more people. I need to pray more often during the day, and I'm just doing that, and I'm not feeling any better. And my best solution at that point was you know, I had a suicide planned. You know, I got to a point of such pain that I just wanted to end it all again. And I knew what that felt like. I'd been there before. But I didn't understand how this could be happening now that I was sober. And my sponsor was asked to speak at a conference in Ocean City. And she went down there and she spoke on a Thursday. She stayed all weekend. And on Saturday morning, she heard this speaker. And she called me when the speaker was... She went up and spoke to the woman, thanked her for speaking, and she called me. And I was up in Bel Air. And she said, "How?" And it was odd. Like, when my sponsor calls me, I answer the phone because, especially if she's at a conference that I know she's not taking calls, I'm like, what's going on? And she called me, and she's emotional. I'm like, Kathy, what's going on? And she says, you won't believe what just happened. I heard this woman down here, and she just told your story. She said, this woman is you in 15 years. Or you are this woman. She's you in 15 years. And I said, okay, and she said, you have to talk to this woman. She said, I've never heard anybody that is as much like you. She's like, this is crazy. And she's like crying and emotional. I'm like, okay. So she came back, and we met up like a week or so later, and she gave me this woman's CD, and I listened to it. And it was Sherry R. from Fort Worth, Texas. And I will never forget listening to that CD. This woman did tell my story. And she knew the things that I was thinking and the things I was feeling. And I'd related to speakers before, but never like this. And she said that it's, you know, when she first got to AA, she was handed this CD. In fact, it's what prompted her to come to AA. And it was June from Los Angeles, California. And this woman was talking about this pain that she had felt. And again, like this, she... Her June story and could relate to the way that I could relate to her. And she started coming to AA because of that. And at 3.5 years sober, she got to a point of complete misery. And she didn't know what to do. And like me, she was ready to just go put a bullet in her brain. And she went to one more meeting, and she walked out of there. And this old sponsor she had looked at her and said, "I'm tired of watching you die." She said, "I just don't think this is working for me anymore." And she said, "Well, why don't you call up June and ask her if she thinks AA works?" And so she did, and this woman started teaching her things and started teaching her actions to take. And she said that after she did that, her life was amazing. She felt happier than she had ever felt. And so I wanted to know. I have a pride and ego that doesn't let me ask for help, so I didn't. Funny thing again, my job sends me to Houston, Texas.
Go figure.
And I didn't trust myself going out of town. Because I know what I used to do when I go out of town. And I got to the airport and I called up Sherry R. And I've never met this woman before in my life. But she didn't answer. We played phone tag the entire time I was in Houston. But it gave me enough hope. The thought that I might be able to talk to her and she might be able to give me some answers gave me hope. And I came back home. And no sooner did I get off that plane and back to my friend's house who picked me up, did she call. And she talked to me, and I told her how I was feeling and my plan and what I was thinking. And she said, "It's really simple, really." And I said, "Really?" And she said, "Yeah, you're selfish and you're self-centered." She said, "It's all over the book." I said, "I know I'm selfish and self-centered." She said, "No, but you're really selfish and self-centered." I'm like, "Okay, what do I do about this?" She said, "I'll tell you the same thing that June told me." She said, "For 3.5 days, I want you to go and improve the lives of other people. I don't want you to think about yourself for 1 second of it." And I said, "How do I do that?" And she said, "Well, for me, when I was by myself, that was the hardest time." And she said, "I would put in June's CD and I'd listen to it everywhere I went." And actually, back then, it was the 80s. She had a tape. She said, "I put that tape in, I put in my Walkman, and I walk around campus, and I just listen to it wherever I went." And I said, "Okay." So for 2 days, I did this. And she said, "You know, go visit somebody in a nursing home that you don't know. Slip somebody $5 when they're not looking. Go and try and improve the life of somebody else." I said, "Okay." And I tried this for 2 days, and I was more miserable than anything. And I called her back up, and I said, "I don't get this. I've been doing this for 2 days, and I still feel like crap." And she said, "Keep doing it. Keep doing it." She said, "Don't try. Do." She said, "Half measures avail us nothing." And she hangs up. I'm like, "Okay." So I went for another couple days. And when I really did it, I mean really did it, for 3.5 days, I felt amazing. It was a Wednesday night, and I'm driving up to a meeting. I got this girl in my car, and I'm driving. And all of a sudden, I feel okay. I can't tell you what it was, and I can't explain it. But something was different. And I felt okay. And I felt more than okay. I felt happy. I felt happy to be alive. I felt amazing. And I called June back the next, or I called Sherry back the next day. And I said, "I feel amazing. This is great, you know." And she's like, "Okay, keep doing it." Okay. You know, and she said, "You know, that's what this is about." She said, "Yeah, you can go pick up some new girls. You can pray every day." She said, "But that's what this is really about." And I was like, "Okay." So today I have an amazing life. I'm happy. I can tell you that I had to borrow money to put in a gas tank just to get up here. I am broke, like broker than broke. My brother's no longer coming to these rooms. He's looking at a few felonies. He's got 5 charges. He's looking at 20 years. He goes to trial in December. My mom lost her memory about 1.5 years ago. My dad's going to have surgery. And that aunt that I was really close with told me this week she has cancer. And she has chemo. She's going through chemo right now. She came home today. And now I get to go and be there for her. You know, I get to pay it forward back to her. And, you know, I could, in the past, I'd have self-pity. And I'd look at myself and be like, "Oh, woe is me, my life," you know. But today, it's like, you know, those things make me stronger. And if I'm supposed to go through those experiences, whatever it is in my life, so I can then share that with somebody else and they get something out of it, then I'm willing to feel that pain and I'm willing to go through whatever it is. And, you know, when that night I looked up at the stars and I said, you know, I'll do anything, I'll go anywhere, as long as I can feel okay. And then weeks after that, my drinking takes off. I look back at that, and God kept his end of that promise. I did go anywhere, and I did do a lot of stuff. And now my life is okay. And I told him I'd do anything, and I'm still trying to keep that promise. Because it's worth it to do it. I'm extremely grateful to be an alcoholic. And when I heard people come, when I first came here, I heard people say that, I thought they were crazy. And now I understand what they were talking about. Because not only do I have a life beyond my wildest dreams, I couldn't have even drugged myself if I tried. So thank you for having me here. Thank you.